All right, welcome to Computer Science 50, Introduction to Computer Science 1. My name is David Malin, and I will be your instructor this semester. So even if you have no idea how the computer you own or the laptop you own works, and perhaps some of you are just a little bit scared of it, you probably know at the end of the day, everything that goes on inside that computer boils down to zeros and ones, aka bits. So where are all these zeros and ones stored? Well, you probably also know that inside your computer somewhere is this thing called a hard drive. Whether you have a desktop, you'll have something like this. A laptop, you'll have something like this. But mechanically, they pretty much work the same. In fact, in some of your iPods or devices much like these. Quick question, how do these things work? This is literally like a 200 gigabyte hard drive that I pulled from a non-functioning desktop computer. What goes on inside these things? Well, as you can kind of tell, and I'll start passing this around, there are these things called platters, essentially these metal disks inside of hard drives that have millions, billions of tiny magnetic particles on top of them. And essentially, if you align these magnetic particles, say, north-south, we might say that that particle is simply representing a one. By contrast, if you flip that magnetic particle over, putting south to north, well, we might say that that particle is essentially representing a zero. And it's certainly a bit more complicated than that, but at the end of the day, the storage of zeros and ones, the so-called language of computers, all boils down to, on hard drives at least, the storage of these magnetic particles. Well, it turns out that these larger devices are much like these floppies that probably most of you in this room don't even use anymore, and most of your computers probably don't even come with them. But go ahead and very carefully slide this little silver metal piece, if you took a floppy on your way in, and you can sort of see just part of one of these circles. This one is in fact floppy, as the name of the disks implies, but it functionally works almost exactly the same as the hard drive. So let's go ahead and turn our attention for a moment to a little video, granted a cheesy video, but nonetheless a bit illustrative.
Works with 3.5-inch floppy disks.
Let's not, actually.
The floppy drive you see here.
All right. What a perfect way to begin today. I'm the only one that doesn't see where this program is actually running. There we go. All right, it opened the wrong part. Wow, makes you want to start this lecture all over again, huh? All right, let's go ahead and play it with the right software this way. And here we go.
The floppy drive you see here works with 3.5-inch floppy disks. They're the type most often used to carry new programs, save data, or to move files from one PC to another. The part of the disk we see is actually just a hard plastic shell. The working disk, which is inside, is protected by a sliding metal shutter. This thin inner disk, called the cookie, is coated not with chocolate chips, but with a thin layer of magnetic material. When you slip the disk into your floppy drive, a system of levers pushes back the metal shutter. The levers also pinch two read-write heads closer so they almost touch the cookie. A motor at the base of the drive spins the cookie based on commands from your PC. The PC also signals another motor to move the read-write heads back and forth over the surface of the disk so they can read or write data. Before your PC writes data, your drive first checks the Write Protect tab in the corner of the floppy disk. If it is open, light from a tiny diode shines through and strikes a diode on the other side. This diode then says to your PC,
"Don't write on this disk."
But if the tab is closed, no light gets through, and the PC knows it's okay to write data.
All right, so admittedly, it's a little embarrassing even showing you that video. I have never once, other than this man's voice, heard the thing inside of this thing referred to as a cookie. But nonetheless, let's go ahead and do the following. Ultimately, this course is about sort of tearing apart conceptually, a lot of which is currently unfamiliar to you. Go ahead, watching out for your neighbor's eyes, though, since there's a little spring in these things, and just go ahead and pull off the metal tab that you slid over just a moment ago. So now you can actually push your finger against that little floppy disk, so to speak. And let's take this one step further, if only for the sake of drama here. Go ahead and insert your fingers wherever seems possible and just take the plastic cover off this thing and literally take out the so-called floppy disk. No, know, right? So pretty underwhelming once you actually get inside there. But that's exactly the takeaway. Underneath all of this technology, at the end of the day, are fairly simple things. You can't see these metakinetic particles, but if you do go ahead and wipe your fingers across this disk, you've certainly hurt or corrupted any of the data that might in fact have been on these floppies. But again, the takeaway is just the simplicity of it all. And those of you who are sitting in this room thinking that computer science is perhaps not for you, technology in general has never been for you, just realize that all of this stuff has been man-made over the years. And at its core, some of these things are fairly simple. It's just that we have 30, 40 years of technology built on top of some of these simplest technologies to get us to the point where we are today. Just to make this a bit more technical now, and this is not an electrical engineering course by any means, especially as this topic's about to be introduced by this same voice again, let's just take a look at exactly how these here magnetic particles are in fact aligned in the spirit of ones and zeros.
To write data onto a floppy disk, your PC tells the drive to send tiny pulses of electricity through the heads. The pulses make the heads act like little electromagnets. Each head creates a magnetic field that reaches the surface of the disk. Remember the magnetic coating on the cookie? The magnetic field alters the tiny particles in this coating. If current runs through the heads one way, the particles are arranged with their north and south poles in one direction. But if current flows through the heads the opposite way, the polarity reverses. To read data from the disk, the read-write heads move into the same position over the cookie, but this time the process is reversed. The cookie particles create a magnetic field in the coils of wire, and this creates a current in the read-write head. The disk drive detects this flow of electricity and passes it onto the PC. The PC translates the back and forth current changes into a series of ones and zeros, the binary language of computer data.
Okay, so at the end of the day, it just boils down to the magnetization of these particles. You get zeros and ones. But let's ask the more interesting question now. Who cares? So suppose you do have this ability to store nothing other than zeros and ones inside of a computer. Well, why is that, in fact, even useful? Well, it turns out, as this woman's voice now suggested, that using the so-called binary alphabet of zeros and ones, you can represent any possible number. We all speak the so-called decimal system, 0 through 9, and then combinations thereof. Computers only speak binary, combinations of zeros and two. So let's take a moment here, and for those unfamiliar, teach you how to count, not in decimal, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, but instead in binary. And I'll toss a softball out there. If all you have in the world are zeros and ones, just take a stab at it. How would you go about representing the decimal number we know as zero? Okay, so not a hard class thus far. So in fact, it's true. So it's just all zeros. So you often hear of zeros and ones talked about in terms of turning something on, a one, turning something off, a zero. Like a light bulb is on, might represent a one. A light bulb is off, it might represent a zero. Often intertwined in that kind of conversation is mention of fairly technical things like transistors, which are nothing more than switches that turn something on or turn something off. So we might represent 8 bits, that is 8 zeros and 1s, by say these light bulbs here. And if all 8 of those bulbs, a byte, B-Y-T-E, of bits, if you will, if are all set to off, well, that number there is simply representing zero. Now take another stab. If you have only zeros and ones in the world, how do you go about representing the number one? All right, so again, not all that non-obvious. All the things to the left are just like leading zeros. You could put as many zeros to the left of a decimal number as you want, but 00123 is still the number we know as 123. Same in this case. We've got 8 bits, but we only needed one of them, so that's fine. The rest are assumed to be zeros. Well, how do you count up from there? Well, then you start toggling these bits, so to speak. You turn one off, you turn the next one over to the left on. How would you go now to the number 3? Well, take a guess. If we've now got represented on the board 0, 1, 2, intuitively, what's probably the pattern here? So 1, 1. Just flip on the bit that's still off. And so now we have 1, 1. So now we're sort of in this situation where if we want to represent the number 4, we can't just use those 2 rightmost bits, because it looks like the biggest number we can represent with just 2 light bulbs, 2 bits, looks like the number 3. Well, how do we go about making room for the number 4? We'll take a guess. What do we do with these bits to get to the decimal number 4? So turn off those 2, but flip the next one on. So now we have light bulb on, light bulb off, light bulb off. Now, how do you actually, and just to make this more real, here's the before, turn those zeros into light bulbs into zeros and ones after. So before, after. What you have here is what we simply know as bytes of bits in the binary system. So what's really the pattern here? Well, as you might have noticed, at the top row of this little chart, there's these column headers, which I've labeled the ones column, the twos column, the fours column, the eights column. There's clearly a pattern there, multiples of two going on up from right to left. But why are those placeholders actually useful? Well, take note of, say, this last row of bits that we have here, 100. Well, why? Does that represent what we know as the decimal number 4? Well, take a look. In the 4's column, we have a 1. So that's like 4 times 1 is 4. So plus a 0 in the 2's column, a 0 in the 1's column. And so the additive sum is just 4. You use that same logic for the number 3. So for the number 3, in the second to last row, we had nothing in the 128's through the 4's columns. But in the 2's column and the 1's column, we had 1's. So we have 1, 2. Plus 1, 1 gives us the decimal number we know as 3. And just to make this more clear, if this is not wholly unfamiliar to us, if you consider what we know as the decimal number 123 from grade school, why is that the decimal number 123? Well, recall the same system, the same trick. We had the ones place, we had the tens place, we had the hundreds place. So why is this 123? It's 1 100 plus 2 times 10 plus 3 times 1 gives us what we know as 123. So this idea of binary, or base 2 as it might be known, is not so foreign to you. It's simply all you have at your disposal ultimately is just two values, zeros and ones. Whereas from grade school onward, we've been used to having 10 digits at our disposal, 0 through 9. So with that said, a little application of knowledge just learned, perhaps. Cambridge's zip code is 02138. If you're a freshman and don't know that yet, you will soon. 02138. What is that in binary? Granted, the easiest way to answer this is skipping ahead in your lecture notes, but there are dashed lines here for your intellectual stimulation. 02138 is what in binary? From top row to bottom row. All right. The solution is now on the board. Hopefully, the first row everyone got, zero, all zeros, one, similarly pretty easy because we just did that a moment ago. But hopefully, your answers check up against this. Turns out the only value we haven't already seen on the board is that 8. Well, why does that work? Well, 1000 in that last row is obviously 18 plus 04s plus 02s plus 01s. All right, that's it. That is all there is to binary, to the so-called zeros and ones that only computers speak. And sad to say, as perhaps aspiring computer scientist, you can now appreciate the, dare say, humor of such comics as these. Yeah, if you're laughing, you belong in computer science, perhaps. So, all right, so that's all fine and good. You can represent numbers, 0 through 8 certainly, and beyond, if we just keep using more and more of these bits, more and more of these zeros and ones. But that's not all that useful when computers today don't obviously just calculate numbers. They have graphics, and they display characters of text. They allow you to write documents. Well, it turns out, and we'll revisit this later in the course, that computers are as sophisticated as they are today because they use those zeros and ones, this trivial alphabet of zeros and ones, to represent any possible types of data, including, for instance, alphabetical letters. So this chart, scary or overwhelming as it might seem now, is simply a mapping. using what's called the ASCII coding system, where in the right-hand columns that are each in red, you have some familiar characters. In red, these are like characters on a keyboard. So you have A through A in lowercase, A through Z in lowercase, A through Z in uppercase, a whole bunch of punctuation. And then next to each of those red characters, you essentially have the numeric codes that computers traditionally use to represent those values. So with that said, and the leftmost column under DEC just means decimal, what is the decimal value that a computer uses to represent internally the letter capital A? All right, so 65. And how about lowercase a? 97. Okay, if you take away no two other numbers from this so-called ASCII coding system 2 weeks from now in a forthcoming problem set, know that by just remembering 65 and 97, turns out you can remember 50 other additional characters as well, because they're all obviously linearly increasing. So that's it for today. That's the hardcore introduction to zeros and ones, binaries, how computers speak. What then is this course all about? So here's the deal. CS50 certainly has a reputation, and it has for 10, 20 or so years since it's been around, even if some of its prior forms. I myself was an undergrad in 95 to 99, and I was a gov major for the first year and a half that I was here. And I certainly came into this school as sort of a geek, you know, the kind of kid who, I heard it up here, might have laughed at like the Foxtrot cartoon once I knew binary. But even so, and I was a UA at the time too, even so, CS50 had this reputation that I think it still, to a large extent, has today, which is that it takes a lot of work. It's really hard. It's really only for those computer genius friends of yours. Or in any case, it has a reputation that I think is much larger, much scarier than, say, the course actually is itself. And just on a whim, really, or finally, come sophomore year, I had some additional confidence, perhaps, and I decided, all right, what the heck? I'll take CS50. I know I like this kind of stuff. I'll just ignore all the sort of advice that my friends have given me to the contrary. I took the course pass-fail up until the last possible day when you could switch to a letter grade. And for me, the change was simply because for the first time, you know, really of any of the courses I had taken thus far as an undergrad, like, I loved this stuff. And it was the first time for me, and you can make fun of me for this in subsequent classes, it was the first time for me that homework, honestly, was fun. And there was this coincidence of, like, sort of my interest sort of on an extracurricular level, and though I did other things besides computers extracurricularly, and what actually was assigned work. And this is absolutely more of a commentary on perhaps my social life at the time than on Computer Science 50. But I used to look forward, frankly, to like sitting down on Friday night and like tackling the newest problem set. And that, too, is worthy of making fun of me for in the future. But this is only to say that this course certainly has personal significance to me. And all of these folks you see sitting here in these blue t-shirts, the teaching fellows who I'll introduce again in a bit, really feel passionately about this course. For me, it really turned me on to an academic field and ultimately a degree program that I just had no idea I would take such an interest in. And the funny thing is, these days, last year, the past 5 years, most of you in this room are certainly not going to become, certainly as a result of this class, computer science majors. In fact, CS majors constitute to the significant minority of the students in CS50 these days, because rather we have students taking this class as an elective, as a related field requirement for their own concentration. And the fact of the matter is, because this course really has sort of a side effect or as a framework for introducing computer science teaches you programming, honestly, the rewards of a course like this, an introductory course in computer science, really are huge in that they really can be applicable to your own field. Whether you're a science major, whether you're a math major, whether you're simply involved in a student group and need to actually use computers, to use websites, to actually make your lives easier and automate some processes. So just realize that the takeaways from this course are far more than I think than can be conveyed in this fairly arcane language that you see in the course catalog. Frankly, you read this description and it doesn't sound like the course for most people. But if you dive deeper into the syllabus, the course's website, conversations with these folks here who have all taken the course, hopefully you'll realize that this course is not what its reputation perhaps makes itself out to be. So with that said, what are the expectations of students who do in fact take this course? Quite simply, attend all lectures and sections, complete 8 problem sets, take 3 quizzes, produce a final project. A popular question to address at the start of the term is there a final exam? And the answer is no. grades are computed and will be weighted as follows. Essentially, the breakdown will be as such. This is elaborated on in the syllabus, but realize, because this course is certainly a lot of work, it does have this reputation, and I should make this point clear. Undoubtedly, Computer Science 50 comes with a non-trivial workload, and by that we mean 10 plus hours a week, 10, 15 hours a week. For many of you freshmen in the room, that sounds like a scary lot of hours. Hopefully, if you're sophomore, junior, senior, or beyond, you realize that 10 hours, that wasn't so bad back in the day. So just realize that your perception of courses and course loads, I do think, changes over time. And just to give you the extreme counterpoint, perhaps to scare you out of computer science altogether, when I took Computer Science 161, Operating Systems, when I was an undergrad, that course, by contrast, and it's an elective, you don't have to take this course, was about 40 hours a week every other week. So that's sort of the other extreme, and that explains my Saturday nights as well that semester. So, with that said, the course definitely comes with its own workload, a non-trivial amount, but the thing is, you're not going to learn computer science. You're not going to learn how to program listening to a guy like me up here, or even listening to your teaching fellow once a week. It's only in sitting down in front of your own machine and actually solving problems, fighting with the computer, making it do what you want it to do, and getting your programs to work that you really exit with a new skill set. So it is simply par for the course, frankly, putting a lot of time into a course like this. But again, what you get out of it, hopefully, is the ability to, one, solve problems in ways that your peers simply cannot without, say, even that skill of programming alone, and honestly, at speeds that others, including yourself as of now, perhaps, could not solve those same problems at. Computers facilitate precisely those kinds of solutions. However, because there is a lot of work, and we certainly appreciate that we all have occasional bad days or weeks, you will be able to drop your lowest problem set, you'll be able to drop your lowest quiz score, and there's a great deal more infrastructure in place of support structure for you throughout the semester. You may, as I started 2 years ago, take the course pass-fail, simply come up to me or one of the teaching fellows to discuss as much, but we are fine, certainly, with that. The course's website will contain much of what you need to succeed or to review in this course. We'll defer a walkthrough of salient features in the future for your keystroke saving convenience. You can also just type cs50.org these days and it will redirect you to the FAS address, which is a little harder to remember. The email address for the staff on which I and all the teaching fellows are is simply cs50@fas. But one of the features of this course that over the years has proved rather popular, if only because of its anonymization of posts and its 24-hour accessibility, is the so-called bulletin board on the course's website. You're presumably familiar with this concept. The bulletin board will be accessible in about a week's time, but we do urge you throughout the semester to post your questions anonymously to this bulletin board so that you certainly might benefit from an answer from fellow students or ourselves, or certainly other students can benefit from the same. All right. Books. There are four at the Coop, all of them unreasonably expensive. Here's the deal with the books. So there are no required books for this course. These days, I'm not really a fan of coercing students to buy books, particularly because of their cost. The course is not designed around using a specific textbook. However, we did go ahead and recommend any of four books as follows. Essentially, the trend that this course fights every year is to balance as effectively as possible those students coming into this course who are very comfortable with computers, maybe took AP Computer Science and are here really to fill in holes in their knowledge so they can move to higher level courses, and then there's the other type of student who is genuinely scared of their computer or feels that they should know something about programming or computer science, but just generally feels that they are not quite at the same skill level as, say, some of the students in their sections. So to accommodate these two different sort of unofficial tracks within the course, one approach that we've taken this year is to recommend either of two books. Essentially, the way we've spun these is as follows. This is a recommended book in the syllabus for, quote-unquote, those less comfortable with either computer science, computers, with the idea of programming. By contrast, this book is what we recommend for those more comfortable. Those of you who have maybe had some programming experience, or even if you haven't, just feel like you're going to be fine in this course. This is sort of, this is more at your level. Effectively, these two books in particular are designed to be at-home supplements to lectures and sections. If you are simply the type of student who learns well from reading books. If you enjoy sort of the crutch that having a book by your side sort of brings after lectures are adjourned, then by all means, flip through either of these two texts, buy one of them, or perhaps just check it, or take a look at it in the library, though I would urge any of you, if you go this route of buying any of the books, follow the link on the course's website to, say, Amazon, and you can get these books significantly discounted. You will not need them for at least a week or two, so you certainly won't be at a disadvantage placing a super saver order sometime this week. This book here is bundled at a discount, quote-unquote, at the Coop. I probably shouldn't really say all these things on film these days, but so be it. This is just a lot of fun, this book. This book is in the spirit of those, granted, cheesy videos that we showed just a bit ago, in that it's essentially a picture book is the wrong word because it's more technical than that, but it's very easily digestible, and it addresses things like how does RAM work, how does a hard drive work, how does a joystick work, how does macOS boot up at startup. Just very bite-sized kinds of topics that if you just like to sort of know a bit more about computers and the internet, it's an interesting book to reference. Laced throughout the problem sets this semester will be sort of one-liner questions like how does a hard drive work? And to this book you can turn, we'll let you turn to like Wikipedia and Google in general for those kinds of questions, but really the purpose of this book in the course is really just to encourage you to dabble in some useful knowledge, but that certainly isn't aligned with the academic spirit of the course. Finally, for those handful of you who might consider yourselves to be or want to be hackers, a wonderfully esoteric book is this Hacker's Delight. You find it perhaps advantageous for a couple of the course's problem sets this year, but really this is a good reference book. For those of you who know you're going to be computer scientists or really intense programmers, it's a wonderful book as to how to optimize, that is, improve your own code. And I found this a wonderful reference in graduate school when a lot of the challenges at hand were not just getting things to work, but getting them to work better than existing solutions, getting them to work faster. So as with a lot of the courses here at Harvard, ours too comes with sections. And if I could draw attention to you guys, if you wouldn't mind standing for just a moment, among our courses teaching fellows are those here in these stylish blue t-shirts today. You will see these in the basement of the Science Center whenever one of these guys is on duty during office hours, though I suspect as semester progresses, they'd much rather you recognize their faces than these t-shirts. So look at them now. These folks will be holding sections, which are 60 to 90 minute sections once a week. They won't start until next week. We won't officially do sectioning until next week. So the first week of sections, next week's, will just be come as you are. Attend any of the available sections, so no rush on that. Thank you guys very much. Let me also draw your attention in back to Katie and Thomas, the course's head teaching fellows. These guys are together as a pair responsible for managing the course administratively. They are a wonderful liaison to the course. If you'd rather speak, if you feel more comfortable speaking with either of them, if perhaps you'd like to discuss your own teaching fellow and how sections going with someone else or myself, just know that these two here are wonderful resources as well and will be responsible for taking care of sectioning in a week's time. So this is, again, a course with a good amount of challenges with it. So what we will be offering in addition to these traditional sections is what we've dubbed super sections, once per week. Essentially, these are sections that students from any individual section are welcome to attend optionally. They'll be led by one or more teaching fellows, and they'll cover the same material from the week, from lectures and sections, but usually with different examples from a different person's perspective. So these super sections, which will also be filmed, are designed and put online, are designed really for those of you who are feeling uncomfortable in the course throughout the semester, who feel like you benefit from hearing things multiple times, and just generally want more of a support structure in place for yourselves. These are purely optional, but they do exist to facilitate your success and really lowering your level of stress in a course like this. In addition, office hours are a traditionally very popular aspect of this course. Now, I know this photo makes you almost want to go to office hours in this very utopian kind of place known as the Science Center. Once you get to the basement, it doesn't look so green and fun anymore. But a very popular and a very common memory of this course is, in fact, the time students spend alongside the teaching fellows in the so-called terminal room, room B14 of the Science Center. It's down the stairs, take a left. It's got a bunch of Linux computers these days, Macintosh computers, PCs, and essentially we hold weekly office hours for many hours a week down there so that you can really have some one-on-one, hands-on assistance with the current problem set, or most anything else. Also this year, what we will be offering on an experimental basis is what the Crimson apparently broke this story this morning before we even had a chance to announce it, the virtual office hour. So thanks to technology, not only will we be able to help you in the basement of the Science Center one-on-one, we'll also be offering what we dubbed virtual office hours in the course's virtual terminal room this year. Essentially, what this will mean is that you, from your laptop or desktop computer, whether you're in your dorm room, whether you're away on vacation perhaps, or whether you're at brain break in the dining hall, you can log into what's effectively a fancy chat room that has not only the ability for teaching fellows, aka moderators, to chat with you either via text-based instant messaging interface or even, though I think this is of questionable efficacy, VoIP, voice over IP, using microphones. You can communicate in two ways with your teaching fellow privately, but we can also share control of and observe your own screen. So you can think of this sort of like CS50's tech support with problem sets. You'll be able to stay in your dorm rooms, we'll be able to stay in our dorm rooms or homes, and nonetheless meet online to assist you with these problem sets. It will be up to you guys to really dictate where we allocate our resources, more to the traditional Science Center office hours or more to these virtual office hours. You are as much a part of this experiment as we are over the course of the semester. So we'll demonstrate that in a future lecture and let you loose on it for the course's first problem set. So, administratively, are there any questions before we survey the material and such that you'll be exposed to in this course? Anything at all? Yes? How long is each problem set? I would say a typical student spends about 10 hours, maybe 15 hours, maybe 5 hours on a given problem set. And there are 8 of them spread over roughly 13 or 14 weeks of the semester. Other questions? Okay, as with several courses here these days, this course is and will be filmed throughout the semester, usually within 72 or 96 hours. Videos in QuickTime formats, Flash formats, MP3 formats will be posted online via the course's website in the form of a podcast and also in the form of the webpage itself, so you can tune in that way. Tonight's lecture, for instance, if you have to duck out early for shopping period, should be online around midnight or so tonight, and the same will be true with a 96-hour window in future lectures. It's also my philosophy with lectures and such that it is more of a distraction than anything, certainly for students like myself, to be constantly scribbling notes for a 60-minute or a 90-minute lecture, really to the detriment, I think, of the intellectual experience of sitting in on class and engaging, dare say, with the person at the podium who's asking and answering questions. So toward that end, one of the additional pieces of support structure we'll provide you with this semester, thanks to the teaching fellows, will be a canonical set of scribe notes, so to speak, whereby each one of the teaching fellows each lecture will be responsible for producing an official, if you will, set of lecture notes that are not meant to take the place of your own notes that you might want to take, but are meant to alleviate you of the mental obligation or the inclination or the stress of trying to scribble down absolutely everything that may be said, particularly when I or when lectures themselves tend to go a bit quickly. So know that in addition, that support structure will be in place for you. So with that said, any questions? So, what's on the agenda for the next several weeks? Well, in the course's first week, namely this Wednesday and Friday, will we introduce you right away to this world of programming. Ultimately, the course focuses on a language called C. It's C and in C++ and nowadays C# that a lot of the programs on your own computers, particularly Windows computers, are written, and it's in C that the course's focus ultimately is. In the beginning, though, we're going to introduce you to the idea of programming and the concepts underlying programming without the distraction of what you'll quickly come to appreciate or abhor as parentheses and semicolon and what on first glance is otherwise fairly arcane syntax. And what we'll introduce instead in just the first week of the course is a programming environment, a graphical programming environment known as Scratch. Scratch essentially will allow you to program, quote unquote, merely by dragging puzzle pieces of sorts that are color-coded and shaped according to the type of logic that they implement. This is perhaps best explained for today's purposes by way of a little demonstration. What I've brought along with us today is, for instance, one Scratch project that a former student of mine implemented, and this is your 5-second overview of what the interface looks like. On Wednesday and Friday, we'll dive into programming in the context of this thing, but I'm going to go ahead and play what, for this student, was the outgrowth of just 1 week of class. The semester semester she took this class, a two-day introduction to Scratch, and this is what she submitted for her homework. It's in the spirit of an animation or a fairy tale, and that there is her first bug. So what was most gratifying for us, the teachers, that semester was this student really had not programmed before. And again, after just a few hours of time with us introducing Scratch and introducing some basic programming constructs like loops and conditions and statements and Boolean expressions, was she able to come back just a few days later and present this to her class. The nice thing about Scratch then is that certainly for those among you who have never programmed before and are just a little bit daunted by the idea of this course at all, is that in just a week's time, you too will be submitting something along these lines, subject entirely to your own creativity. We make no requirements really as to what the thing must do, look like, or sound like, but you'll have this experience, we hope, very early on of actually producing an interactive or a dynamic computer program. And the fact of the matter is, with more traditional languages like Java, C, C++, you just can't get to GUIs, graphical user environments, or really sexy software in just one semester because there's so many steps that you must take before getting to a point of sophistication where you can implement that stuff in these more traditional languages. For this next demonstration of Scratch and this teaser of where we're going next week, I do need a volunteer from the crowd. The catch is, it's a non-speaking role, so you don't need to feel that kind of pressure. The catch is you will appear here on film. And so to satisfy the lawyers and such, we need you to sign your name away, just saying that you realize that you were filmed today and you're okay being on the internet. I don't know. Thomas is not volunteering. So we do need one volunteer. If ever there were a way to prove to your parents that you go to class, come on down. Come on. So this program here simply requires that this was a student, Carlos was his name, who implemented essentially a soccer program whose functionality will largely speak for itself. The only instructions you need to know are that as soon as I click go, you're going to simply want to click with the mouse on the player himself, and he will run and kick the ball. So here we go. I'm starting the program. So go ahead and just click the player with the mouse button when you want him to kick the ball. And the goal is, of course, to hit the target.
Oh, so it's like a timing thing. So.
Exactly. Keep going.
This is harder than it looks.
Get one more. Okay, a round of applause if you could. You know, I heard those comments, and yeah, it's a non-speaking role, but you try hitting a moving target with 200 people watching you. It's probably not the easiest thing. This last demonstration that I wanted to give you also as a teaser as to where we're going in just one week's time, starting this coming Wednesday, was actually submitted by one of the teaching fellows. We sort of, as a get-to-know-each-other exercise this past week, all produced our own Scratch program so that we, too, would experience the same experience that you're about to have over the coming week. This was a favorite of mine, but I love them all, of course. And this one is not interactive, but also speaks to the dynamism and the capabilities of this particular environment that you yourselves will be unleashed on coming this Wednesday. Thank you. So we'll make that available for download on the website. All right, so that's just week zero. What are we doing the next week? So it's in week one of this course. Computer scientists, of course, count starting at zero is the good joke there. We'll introduce C. So come next Monday, will you be introduced to this more traditional language of C, which certainly on first glance is, in fact, more arcane, say, than the puzzle pieces you've just glimpsed a moment ago. But it's literally in the second week of this course that we'll dive in to programming in a more traditional sense with a lot of those constructs, if you will, out of the way in a fun and engaging environment. In week two of the course, we'll continue our exploration of C and the functionality thereof, how to program at a more sophisticated level, but we'll do this, as will be the case throughout the semester, in an interesting domain. We'll look at cryptography, the art of concealing data, among other topics in that same context. In week three, we'll look at some of the more canonical problems in computer science, among them searching, a la Google, and sorting, with which you can actually expedite things like searches, figuring out not out of, say, 12 or 16 doors, but out of a billion doors, behind which is a number that you actually want to find. In week four, we'll talk about what it means to debug software and what it means to design software well. We'll come back to that particular picture, but that is quite literally a picture of a bug. Dare say the first bug. In week five of the course, we'll look similarly in more technical detail at what it means to run a program. When you double-click that icon on your desktop, what exactly is going on inside of the computer? What is going on with the so-called memory and RAM? We'll also look at a rather sexy context for this exploration of digital forensics, recovering data, undeleting files, and introducing you to those kinds of ideas as well. In week six of the course, we begin to look at what are typically called data structures. There are entire courses on data structures at Harvard. What we'll do is scratch the surface at some of the most useful of them, some of the most common of them, most canonical of them, among them tries and hash tables and heaps, binary search trees and links list. It's okay. If none of these topics make sense to you now, if you've never heard of them, that's precisely the point of being here in the first place. In week seven, we'll look at data compression. How do you take a very big file, a very big essay, for instance, and compress it down into something much smaller? We'll look, therefore, at Huffman coding. We'll come back to this idea of bits. How can you actually start writing individual zeros and ones to files on disks in the interests of using as few bits as possible? In week eight, we'll take a look underneath the hood, so to speak, at what's going on when you actually run a program, not in terms of memory, but in terms of its CPU. We'll look at an assembly language that's known as ANT, which is about as low level as you can get to a computer's actual CPU before the language itself becomes just zeros and ones. In week nine, we'll look at a topic known as secure coding. Ask me in about 10 weeks' time, or better yet, tell me in 10 weeks' time why there's a picture of a canary on this slide. And in week 10, we'll be introduced one of the topics that's new to the course this semester, which is an introduction to web-based programming and PHP. So in addition to Scratch and ANT and C, we'll also introduce a popular language called PHP this semester. Those of you who have logged into Facebook obsessively, and perhaps are logged into Facebook right now, might recognize might recognize that that early on, and I believe to this day, was the language in which Mark Zuckerberg wrote Facebook. SQL is the language in which the database queries of Facebook and innumerable other websites used to actually get at databases worth of information. So by week 10 in this course, will you know not just how to make a web page, since we'll spend perhaps 20 minutes on that particular process, but actually how to create dynamic, interactive, database-driven websites. In week 11 of the course, we will figure out what to do based on the kinds of questions and interests that arise over the course of this semester. And in week 12, we have a fun and exciting conclusion, if you will. But it's really in the course's problem sets that you'll get your hands the dirtiest with this material. And it's in the problem sets completion that you'll gain, I think, the most from this course. To give you a sense of what kinds of topics and domains we'll be looking at this semester, the first one, problem set zero, will quite simply be go make your own Scratch project. We'll lay out just a few basic requirements, but for the most part, you are free to design anything that comes to mind and anything within the boundaries of your own imagination. In problem set one, in a couple of weeks' time, we'll introduce C and a bit of Linux to you. In problem set two, we'll look at cryptography, and you'll actually implement programs that both encipher and decipher data that you might want to keep secure. Problem set three, we'll implement the game of 15, which is a name I didn't even know what it applied to. This is that silly little plastic game with all the numbers, and you can move the numbers up and down and left and right, and there's 15 numbers, and one of the squares is empty, and you try to move those numbers around. Apparently it's called the game of 15, and that's what we've been doing in this course. The course has been doing for the past few years. You yourselves will implement that in the language known as C. In problem set four, we'll look at this sexy art of digital forensics. Odds are we will hand to one of the teaching fellows a digital camera and a memory card, have them go take some photos around campus. They'll then turn the camera back over to me. I will accidentally erase the camera's memory card, turn it over to you all, and you're going to recover those photos for us. And you'll also search through some data sets for hidden information of sorts. Problem set five, you will be challenged with implementing a faster spell checker than your classmates. And we'll turn this into a bit of a contest whereby, to test your code, we'll give you some software that essentially runs your spell checker against some fairly large predetermined inputs, and then we'll post to the course's website automatically, say the top 10 or top 20 students' results, so that we can see exactly who is outputting the most efficient code at that point. In problem set six, we'll implement what's called HuffPuff, the Huffman coding algorithm, with which you yourselves will implement software with which to compress and decompress files on your own computers. And finally, in problem set seven, will you actually implement your own dynamic database-driven website. It, though, is the final project that we dare say is ultimately the most gratifying aspect of this course. The problem sets come to a conclusion a week or so before winter break, and the final project is not due for a month or so thereafter. And it's out of the final project that some of the most amazing and most interesting projects come from this course, not only from students who came in with a background in AP computer science, but those who have quite literally never programmed before. Here, too, it will be completely up to you what kind of program, software, programs you produce as part of your final project, but the gauntlet we throw down before you today, ultimately, and will remind you of throughout the course of the semester, is ideally to solve an actual problem, to make something useful, or best yet, somehow impact campus. For the next 4 months, as you walk around campus and have conversations with folks in your extracurricular activities, in your dorm rooms and such, identify problems that might exist on campus or opportunities for software-based solutions. Just a few years ago, there was not a very good Facebook on Harvard College's campus, and a student who you've all heard of went about solving that problem himself, having just had a background in just a few courses in programming. Defined just a few years ago, and I'm trying to spin this without it being attached to my name, just a few years ago, there was no way for students to look up shuttle schedules dynamically on computers or via text message or via AOL instant messaging. So some student who a while back had taken CS50 went about implementing software that solved that particular problem. So the spin that we'd like to give to the final project this year, and you have 4 months to figure out what problem you're going to solve and what contribution you're going to make to this campus. And not to set the bar too high, you can also just make a simple game or a program that's perhaps less ambitious than that, but we want to enervate you early on in the semester, is to keep an eye out for opportunities, processes that you can automate, programs you can write for your student groups, and ultimately give a little something back based only on your own experience in this course. Ultimately, it would be a wonderful thing if your software not only, say, garners the attention, I dare say, of, say, the Crimson, a few of you, but to make something that outlives this course. So should you take Computer Science 50, I will stick around, as will some of the teaching fellows, for the next short while. But today, tomorrow, and Thursday, in this same room from 4 to 5 p.m., we'll be here to answer questions, address concerns. Otherwise, I will see you on Wednesday.